Imagine controlling an empire worth over $22 billion.
Right.
Like an empire larger than the entire assessed value of the American South in the early 1900s. And now imagine doing all of that without actually risking a single dime of your own wealth.
I mean, it sounds like a modern conspiracy theory, honestly.
Oh, totally.
But it was literally just the daily business model for a really tiny cabal of financiers at the turn of the 20th century. And the crazy part is, they didn't use magic.
Yeah.
They didn't even use inside information, at least not in the way we think of it today.
Yeah.
They just weaponized some very basic, almost boring mathematics.
Well, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. Today, we are opening up a truly foundational text of economic history. It's a collection of articles from 1913 and 1914, written by Louis D. Brandeis, famously titled Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It.
Yeah, a total classic.
Our mission here is to uncover the blueprint of how a handful of individuals managed to swallow an entire national economy. And, you know, more importantly, we want to explore why this century-old diagnosis still matters so deeply for you.
Right.
Really, for anyone listening today who has a bank account or an insurance policy or a retirement fund.
Yeah, and to really appreciate the breakdown we're about to do, we kind of have to look at who Louis Brandeis was.
Definitely.
Long before he became a Supreme Court justice, he was this lawyer with an absolute mastery of what he called humble arithmetic.
Humble arithmetic. I love that.
Right. He just had this terrifying ability to look at public ledger books and just, you know, see the structural rot underneath everything.
Well, there's that amazing story about the New Haven Railroad.
Oh, yeah.
Like, about 5 years before that massive railroad completely collapsed, Brandeis publicly predicted its failure. And people thought he was crazy.
Completely crazy.
But he didn't have a crystal ball. He literally just analyze their own published financial figures.
Exactly.
He pointed out that the executives running the railroad were basically operating under the delusion that 2 and 2 make 5. And eventually, gravity always wins.
Yeah, and he took that exact same mathematical precision and aimed it straight at Wall Street.
Right.
So Brandeis set out to expose what was known back then as the money trust. This was essentially a financial oligarchy that had effectively cornered American business.
Wow.
Government investigations at the time had just uncovered all the raw numbers, and Brandeis used those numbers to show the public the invisible plumbing of this entire monopoly.
And the most mind-blowing part of that plumbing, like the secret ingredient powering this world-dominating machine, it wasn't even the banker's personal fortunes.
Not at all.
It was your money. I mean, it was the everyday savings and life insurance premiums of regular working class people.
Yep.
Okay, so let's unpack this. To understand how they actually pulled this off, we have to look at how investment bankers completely abandoned their original job description. What were they, like, actually supposed to be doing?
So historically, the proper sphere of an investment banker was simply to be a middleman. You can think of them as wholesalers, basically.
Okay.
Holy. Let's say a railroad needs to build a new line. Or a city needs to build a bridge, so they issue bonds.
Right.
The investment banker buys those bonds in bulk at a slight discount and then turns around and sells them to individual investors.
Got it.
And they just make a modest, transparent commission on the spread.
Yeah.
It was a perfectly useful, totally necessary function in a growing economy.
But somewhere along the line, the wholesaler got a taste of real power and decided the commission wasn't enough.
Exactly. They wanted to own the factory, the supply chain, and the retail store, too.
They wanted the whole pie.
Right. They wanted to manufacture the securities themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, they started consolidating businesses.
How so?
Well, they would take a dozen independent public utilities or, say, competing railroads, and they'd merge them into one massive bloated trust.
Oh, I see.
By making these corporations so unbelievably huge, they engineered a situation where no local independent bank in Ohio or Illinois could possibly afford to fund them.
Right. They outgrew the local bank.
Exactly. So suddenly, every major enterprise in the entire country was totally dependent on this tiny syndicate of associated New York bankers. The middleman basically promoted himself to the master.
And when the Peugeot Committee, which was a congressional investigation in 1912, when they dug into this, the math they uncovered was just staggering.
Oh, that's wild.
They mapped out the Allied forces. This inner circle was primarily J.P. Morgan and Company, the First National Bank, and the National City Bank.
Just those three.
Yeah. And the committee found that the partners of just these three firms held 341 directorships across 112 different massive corporations.
And we really have to pause and just visualize the scale of that concentration. The total capitalization of those 112 corporations was over $22 billion.
In 1912 money.
Yes. That was more than the assessed value of all property in New England, plus New York.
Jesus.
All of it. Controlled by a handful of men sitting around a few mahogany tables in Lower Manhattan.
But here is where I always get tripped up. Where did those billions actually come from? Like, J.P. Morgan was rich, sure, but his personal wealth was a drop in the bucket compared to the aggregate wealth of America.
Right.
He couldn't just finance $22 billion out of his own pocket.
He didn't have to. The true genius of the money trust was capturing the great reservoirs of the people's savings.
The people's savings.
Specifically, they targeted life insurance companies and bank deposits. Think about how life insurance works mechanically.
Okay.
Millions of everyday people pay their premiums every single month, year after year, and the insurance company doesn't have to pay out that money until someone passes away.
Right, so it just sits there.
Exactly. Mm. It creates this massive, continuously refilling, never-failing pool of liquid cash.
It's like the ultimate piggy bank.
Precisely. Brandeis highlighted three specific titans: New York Life, Mutual of New York, and the Equitable. They had hundreds of millions of dollars flowing in constantly.
Wow.
So the bankers realized, hey, if we can just place our own partners on the boards of these life insurance companies, we won't ever need our own money again.
They just use everyone else's.
Yep. They engineered an endless river of other people's quick capital to play with.
It's almost like a real estate agent who somehow gets access to the buyer's personal bank account.
Yeah, perfect analogy.
And they use the buyer's money to purchase the house, and then they take over the construction company that does the renovations, and then they charge a consulting fee for every single step of the process.
That is exactly what they did.
But wait, I'm stuck on this. How is this actually legal? I mean, if J.P. Morgan is sitting on the board of the bank lending the money, and he's also on the board of the railroad borrowing the money, isn't that a massive, glaring conflict of interest?
Oh, absolutely.
How did they even justify this to the public?
Well, the primary mechanism they used to pull this off was called the Interlocking Directorate.
Interlocking Directorate. Okay.
This is when the exact same individuals sit on the boards of multiple, seemingly independent and often competing companies.
That sounds super shady.
It was. Brandeis argued passionately that this practice offended all laws, human and divine, because it violates the most basic principle of trust, which is no man can serve two masters.
Right, because if I'm buying a house, I want the lowest price possible. But if I'm selling the house, I want the highest price.
Right.
You can't logically represent both sides and get a fair deal for anyone except, what, yourself.
And yet, they did it completely out in the open. The historical record gives us this dizzying example of J.P. Morgan operating what was called his endless chain.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that.
Okay, so J.P. Morgan, or one of his partners, sits as a director of the New Haven Railroad. And in that role, he convinces the railroad that they need to issue a massive new round of bonds. And conveniently, he sells those bonds to his own banking firm, J.P. Morgan & Company.
Okay, so Morgan the banker is underwriting the bonds for Morgan the railroad director.
Exactly.
But the banking firm still needs the raw cash to buy those bonds in the first place. So where do they get it?
They borrow it from the Guarantee Trust Company.
And let me guess who sits on the board of the Guarantee Trust Company directing their loan approvals.
J.P. Morgan.
Oh, my God.
He is literally authorizing a loan from a bank he controls to buy bonds from a railroad he controls. But the chain keeps going.
It keeps going.
Oh, yeah. So now the New Haven Railroad is sitting on a mountain of fresh cash. They need to spend it to upgrade their lines, right?
Right.
So they buy thousands of tons of steel rails from the United States Steel Corporation, who is a founding director of U.S. Steel.
J.P. Morgan.
Yep. U.S. Steel then takes that railroad money and buys electrical supplies from General Electric. Morgan is a director there, too.
You've got to be kidding me.
General Electric buys locomotives from the Baldwin Company. Morgan is on the board. It's a completely closed, airtight loop.
So for every single transaction in that entire macroeconomic chain, J.P. Morgan and Company and the allied banks they control, they're just funding the deal and taking a cut.
At every single stop.
Yes. Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, but let me play devil's advocate for just a second.
Sure.
If you look at this from a purely operational standpoint, Couldn't someone argue that having the smartest financial minds in the country guiding all these connected companies is just like the ultimate efficiency?
That was their argument, yeah.
Like if Morgan knows what the railroad needs and he knows U.S. Steel has the exact capacity to provide it, isn't he just streamlining the whole American economy? Why is this inherently a bad thing?
The bankers absolutely used that exact defense. They painted themselves as the great stabilizers of a chaotic market.
Right.
But Brandeis tore that argument apart by pointing out what he called the evils resultant of the system. First off, it completely suppresses competition. Well, if the same small group of men controls the railroads and the major steel companies, no independent, innovative steel startup in Pennsylvania is ever going to get a railroad contract. The game is entirely rigged against newcomers.
Oh, because the incumbent steel company is owned by the bank that controls the customer.
Exactly that. And when you suppress competition, the monopolist can just extort excessive profits. The interlocking directorate also created this bizarre cartel system known as the Principle of Banking Ethics.
Principle of Banking Ethics? That sounds like an oxymoron.
Truly. The major banking houses basically carved the United States up into spheres of influence, almost like mafia families dividing up a city.
Wow.
They had gentlemen's agreements not to compete for the business of certain corporations.
So, like, if Morgan is underwriting a bond for a specific railroad, another firm like Kuhn, Loeb & Co. agrees to just step back.
Yep.
They won't swoop in and offer the railroad a better interest rate to win the business.
Never. Which completely destroys the free market. It means the corporation, and ultimately the everyday consumer who buys a train ticket or pays for electricity, is paying an artificial high price for capital.
Because there's no shopping around.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no competition, the bankers could extract just staggering, unjustifiable fees. For example, when J.P. Morgan and Company organized the United States Steel Corporation, the banking syndicate took a fee of $62.5 million.
In 1901.
In 1901.
Yeah.
Just for organizing the trust.
That is insane.
They didn't build a single blast furnace. They didn't invent a new way to forge steel. That $62.5 million was purely a promoter's fee.
Wow.
It was essentially a massive toll extracted from the economy simply because they owned the only remaining toll booth for capital.
Okay, so if this system isn't actually driving efficiency or creating real value, what is it doing to American progress?
That is the big question.
Which brings us to one of the most fascinating arguments Brandeis makes, which is dismantling the myth of the Great Initiator.
Right. Wall Street spent a lot of money promoting the narrative that big financiers were the architects of American prosperity. The story was that without their brilliant minds and massive capital initiating these projects, the country's infrastructure would never have been built.
But when you actually look at the historical timeline, the money trust wasn't initiating progress at all.
No, they weren't.
They were actively suffocating it. The true engines of progress, like the radical new inventions that changed the world, were almost never funded by big Wall Street banks.
Never.
The banks only showed up to collect the rent after all the hard work was already done.
The struggles of the early pioneers prove this perfectly. Take Alexander Graham Bell and the telephone.
Okay.
When Bell first developed the technology, he offered his patent to the dominant telegraph monopoly. And they completely dismissed it.
Really?
Yeah, they called it an electrical toy and just outright refused to buy it.
So Bell and his partners basically had to build the telephone industry from absolute scratch.
Pretty much.
They faced total financial ruin. They were scraping by, begging for small local investments, while the established Wall Street capitalists just completely ignored them.
And it wasn't a lack of vision for the bankers, really. It was a structural hostility to innovation.
What do you mean by that?
You have to think about the incentives of the money trust. They already had millions of dollars of their clients' money sunk into telegraph wires and existing infrastructure.
Ooh.
So a disruptive new invention like the telephone is a direct threat to that existing capital.
Oh, wow. So if you're the bank funding the telegraph monopoly, funding the telephone is literally funding the destruction of your own collateral.
That is the crucial insight. Big capital is inherently conservative when it controls a monopoly. And the exact same thing happened with Henry Ford and the automobile.
Let me guess, Morgan didn't fund him either?
Nope. Ford didn't get his start with a massive loan from J.P. Morgan. The early auto industry was built by private individuals taking massive personal chances. In fact, one auto executive later laughed when asked how much the bankers helped initiate the industry. He noted that the bankers only arrived to organize the trusts and take their massive fees after the industry was already proven to be wildly profitable.
So what does this all actually mean for the economy? It's like if the local horse and buggy monopoly somehow gained control of all the regional banks.
Right.
And when Henry Ford walks into the lobby asking for a loan to build a factory, they don't just deny him because it's risky. They deny him because his Model T threatens their massive investments in buggy whips and stables.
Exactly. The trusts aren't the engine of progress, they are the emergency brakes.
Wow.
They buy up patents not to deploy them, but to lock them in a vault so no one else can. And Brandeis warned that America was falling behind countries like Germany in manufacturing innovations precisely because of this concentration of power.
Because the banks wouldn't let anyone innovate.
Right. The financial oligarchy was willing to arrest the development of the entire nation just to protect the dividends of their existing trusts.
Okay, so we've diagnosed the disease. We have this financial oligarchy that uses our own deposits to build interlocking empires, crush competition, charge massive toll booth fees, and stifle human invention.
It's grim.
It is an incredibly bleak picture of the early 20th century. But Brandeis didn't write this just to complain about the math.
No, he didn't.
He offered remedies. He actually believed this disease had a cure.
He did. And the cure required two things: radical transparency and cutting out the superfluous middleman entirely.
This leads to arguably the most famous quote Brandeis ever produced. He wrote, "Sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants, electric light the most efficient policeman."
It's such a brilliant metaphor.
Yeah.
Because the power of the money trust absolutely relied on darkness.
Yeah.
The secret commissions, the hidden interlocking boards, the obscure syndicate agreements, all of it only worked because the public couldn't see the plumbing.
Right.
Brandeis argued that if you mandate real, comprehensive disclosure of all banker commissions and profits to the investors, the system would immediately start to collapse under its own weight.
And he specifically wanted to destroy the archaic legal doctrine of caveat emptor, right? Like, let the buyer beware.
Exactly.
For decades, bankers defended themselves by saying, hey, we're just mere merchants. If a customer buys a bad bond, well, that's the customer's fault for not doing their research.
Which is crazy.
But Brandeis completely reframed this. He argued that when a banker sells you a security, they aren't just selling you a bag of flour. They are acting in an advisory capacity.
Because the power dynamic is inherently unequal. The banker has all the information.
Exactly.
If that banker is secretly pocketing a massive commission to offload a highly risky security onto you, that isn't commerce. That's fraud. You have a right to know the exact compensation they are receiving to push that specific bond.
But transparency was really only step one. Brandeis went further and advocated for direct action.
Yes, he did.
He asked a remarkably simple question. If the bankers are just taking the public's deposits from the bank and lending that money to the cities to build roads, why don't the cities just ask the public for the money directly?
Right, cut them out.
Why pay the Wall Street middleman his massive fee at all?
And the historical examples he points to of this self-help are incredible. Mm. Cities actually began bypassing Wall Street entirely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When Mayor Blankenberg in Philadelphia needed to raise money, the standard procedure was to go to a Wall Street syndicate. The syndicate would demand a high interest rate, take their multi-million dollar cut, and then sell the municipal bonds to the public.
The usual racket.
Right. But Mayor Blankenberg skipped them. He offered over $4 million in city bonds over the counter directly to the citizens of Philadelphia.
Wow.
And he sold them completely out in 2 days.
That is amazing. And the St. Paul experiment is even more fascinating to me because it required a total psychological shift.
So the $10 bonds.
Right. Mayor Johnson in St. Paul needed to fund city projects, but municipal bonds were historically sold in these massive denominations, like thousands of dollars.
Right. Way out of reach.
Only the very rich or the banks could afford to buy them. So Mayor Johnson decided to issue municipal bond certificates in denominations as low as $10.
It was a revolutionary democratizing of finance. He essentially turned City Hall into a direct savings bank for regular working class people.
That's brilliant.
Citizens who used to hoard their cash under their mattresses were suddenly walking into City Hall to invest in the streets they walked on every day. They had roughly 2,000 individual purchasers making average deposits of around $300.
Wow.
The city got the funding it needed without paying a dime to a Wall Street syndicate, and the citizens got a safe, reliable return on their savings.
Let me pause you there, though. This sounds amazing in a textbook, but I imagine it was incredibly difficult to pull off at first.
Oh, definitely.
Like, if you are a regular person in 1913 and the banking industry has spent decades convincing you that high finance is this highly complex, dangerous magic that only men in suits can perform, isn't it intimidating to suddenly buy a bond directly from the city?
That was a massive hurdle, for sure. The public's reluctance wasn't a lack of money, it was a lack of financial education. The money trust relied on the illusion that finance was mystical.
Right.
But cities like St. Paul and others solved this by simply marketing these bonds like any other consumer good. They ran full-page, easy-to-understand newspaper ads.
Oh, cool.
They explained the terms simply. They even set up booths to sell municipal bonds in local department stores.
That is so smart. By taking it out of the marble banking halls and putting it next to the shoes and coats, they totally demystified it.
Exactly. Once they applied basic consumer marketing, they proved something incredible. The aggregate financial power of the local community was vastly greater than the power of the Wall Street bankers.
Yeah.
The banker was, in many cases, entirely superfluous.
So, to sort of summarize this incredible journey, Brandeis pulled back the curtain to show us that a few elite financiers didn't build their monopolies using their own genius or their own risk. Yeah. They used your bank deposits and your life insurance premiums. They built this endless chain of interlocking boards that suffocated independent inventions, drove up prices, and extracted massive fees from the American public.
Yeah.
But he also showed us that this concentration of power isn't like a force of nature. Through radical transparency, that sunlight, and through community self-reliance, the public actually has the mathematical power to bypass the middleman and take control back.
And, you know, the sheer arithmetic of a $22 billion financial web absolutely shocked the American public in 1914. But if we pull this forward to today, it leaves us with something really profound to think about.
What's that?
Look at your own life right now. Think about the frictionless digital apps where you stash your cash, or the massive passive index funds that hold your retirement savings. The mechanics have changed, sure, but the pooling of capital really hasn't.
That's a good point.
So you have to ask yourself, what invisible webs are your daily digital deposits weaving right now? And more importantly, who is sitting on the interlocking boards of your digital world?
Are those interlocking boards using your money to build the future you actually want? Or are they just using your premiums to protect their own buggy whips? It's definitely something to think about. Keep questioning the plumbing behind the systems you use every single day. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.